her in.
The moment a police marine unit first arrived on the scene of that deadly bridge collapse in Baltimore.
Key bridge is down. It was last reported at least several vehicles in the water with several people still unaccounted for.
You hear an officer shouting up to the crew on the dolly, that massive cargo ship that brought the bridge down.
Is anybody hurt? Just a one cut to the fingers?
In the dark of night, rescuers desperately searching for six construction workers who were on that bridge when it plunged into the water.
Searchers found the body of the last of the six construction workers in the water just a few days ago. Sean Diddy Combs Friday asking a federal judge to dismiss a lawsuit alleging that he and two co-defendants raped a 17-year-old girl in a New York recording studio in 2003, saying it was false and a hideous claim filed too late under the law. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Watch out! You got me!
The galaxy is safe once again.
In the pretend universe, kids play with pretend guns. In the real world, it's up to us to make sure they don't get their hands on a real gun. If you have a gun in the house, keep it locked, unloaded, and stored separately from ammunition. Safe gun storage saves lives. Learn how to make your home safer at nfamilyfire.org. That's nfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by N Family Fire, Brady, and the Ad Council.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
The fantastic Jane Matt Nair of Matt Nair on Air. I'm a big fan of like the Rose Bowl, the Orange Bowl, the Cotton Bowl. Well, now from Snoop Dogg, they're going to have the Snoop Bowl, the Snoop Bowl. How about that, Jane?
I think we're missing the obvious. Where's the Punch Bowl? Where's the Toilet Bowl? I think that there are other bowls that are being neglected.
I think it could maybe be the Snooper Bowl, though.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station. And on the app. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. The Maggie Dawn Show.
We're going to have policy arguments for the rest of time. But at base, I want my president to be a decent person. I firmly believe that Joe Biden always is trying to do the right thing, that he is a decent man. And in sharp contrast, we've got a man who thinks it's a good thing that stars get to commit sexual assault. And we know that because he said it.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Todd Albaugh Show.
Terry Barr, host of Slice of Wisconsin here on Civic Media. Mr. Zommers, what is that called?
My Wife is Drunk by Terry's favorite, Alvin Stasinski.
There you go.
Yeah. It's so funny to listen to a polka because you think, where did that song come from?
Right? We actually had one person text during the break there said, how about the Meadow Muffin Polka?
Todd, let's quickly write that and make it.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Birth doulas help new mothers with the stress and anxiety of childbirth. But there's another type of doula, people who support people who are dying. Terry D. has more.
Death doulas or end-of-life specialists give spiritual and emotional support to people nearing death in a non-medical setting. Kim Burgess is an end-of-life doula and certified adult geriatric nurse practitioner. She says fulfilling a dying person's wish to be in their desired setting is important.
People wanted to stay in their home, their comfort of their home, their own surrounding, their own food, their own loved ones. So I loved being able to support people in that role.
Training to become an end-of-life doula happens in workshops with required reading and work-study assignments. Since it is not a federally recognized field, insurance companies do not cover these services. Death, or what is sometimes called the other side, can produce feelings of fear or a sense of denial, especially if a terminal condition has been diagnosed. Burgess says it is a 24-hour job for loved ones helping someone in these final days or weeks. And she's encountered families who are unprepared for the caregiving needs.
And a lot of times their family is saying, we're just overwhelmed. And we have hospice involved, but we still feel like we need some more support. An end-of-life doula can be there given the family reassurance or making some slight suggestions.
Doulas can also help plan an advance directive, instructions a person can leave behind about their funeral service or cremation, what to do with a pet, or help writing a loving message to family and friends. This is Terry D. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm Corey Hartman with your forecast for today. Slight chance of a shower. Otherwise, partly sunny and 66, a bit breezy out of the northwest. For tonight, partly cloudy, 49 with a slight chance of a shower. Chances for showers and thunderstorms on your Sunday afternoon. Otherwise, sunshine, 79. More storms Sunday night.
It's 51 at our studios.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, Wisconsin comedian Rob Breckenridge joins me in studio for some laughs, and we discuss World Cocktail Day with an expert Wisconsin bartender.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allball Show.
And the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
Welcome to our weekly, our weekend venued broadcast. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, indeed, I am your host for this hour and also the next hour on our weekend program here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. This is Amicus, a law review. As you know, we take our name from our adopted commission, our purpose to conduct a review, some analyses, some deliberations, some considerations of those major news stories of our times in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in our state, our nation, and our world. Amicus, as you know, is a legal term. It's derived from the Latin. It is a term to describe a friend, often a friend of the court. When the phrase is amicus curiae, it's an individual, an organization, an entity of some kind that assists in understanding, appreciation, or assessment of some relevant issues of the day. Often those issues affecting the courts, affecting all of us in our broader society. Some information provided, some insight, some perspective, some expertise that the court deciding a particular case may not especially have available to it. And so that is indeed our adopted mission on this, our weekend program, also for Civic Media generally, our goal also to involve you, our listeners, here on these broadcast stations of Civic Media throughout Wisconsin and beyond. I am joined in our Waukesha studio this weekend by my terrific producer, Max, and together we're taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. That number once again, 844-967-2789. 2789. Max and I are here to take your phone calls, also taking your questions and your inquiries through the Civic Media app. Go online and get your questions, your inquiries to us. Now, what is our syllabus? What is our agenda for the next 2 hours here on our weekend broadcast? It is, as always, ambitious but achievable. Lots and lots of things going on in our nation and our world this past week and beyond. We're going to talk about all of those in the next 2 hours, and once again, inviting you to be a part of that conversation by asking questions and posing inquiries about things that we talk about this morning. Let me talk about that syllabus right now. Necessarily, the continuing major story of our times, but also in history, is this trial going on of the former president. His name is Donald Trump. And he is on trial in a state court in Manhattan. Criminal charges against him, 34 charges, alleging that he violated New York state law when it came to providing accurate and complete and comprehensive reporting on financial transactions. 34 counts altogether premised upon some falsified ledgers, some checks, some accountings, all of this, some invoices along the way, all of that alleged against Donald Trump. He is the singular defendant. And all of that premised upon, as we all know well, upon this notion that there was payments of monies to various people, including Stormy Daniels, to keep her quiet in anticipation of the 2016 presidential election. All of that going on, several weeks now into the trial. We're going to talk about the significant events from very late last week, tying back to our broadcast of just last weekend, and then talking about the major developments in that trial of this week. We necessarily spend some time on this weekend broadcast, Amicus Alora View, talking about this, not simply because it is in the headlines now, but because it is history. And it's important not only for us as we live through this history to have a sense of the civics behind all this, to have a sense of some of the evidentiary, even the legal procedure behind all this, because it is the roadway, the pathway to understanding the larger issues. We're going to talk about some of the witnesses past and anticipated for this coming week, and also beginning with some important statements made by the presiding justice. His name is Juan Merchan, sometimes called a judge. They call them justices in New York. And the judge made two, arguably even three, major pronouncements this past week about the conduct of the trial as it goes ahead. We will be talking about those things as well as we pursue, as we will continue to do on this weekend broadcast, our accounting of all of that. And then necessarily because of the time period, because we are eventually coming to the end of this trial, we'll talk as well in our weekend broadcast about the status of those other trials. There are three other criminal trials also pending out there, also naming, among others, defendant Donald Trump. One of those is a federal case in the Southern District of Florida. We're going to talk about something significant that happened in connection with the scheduling of that case. There's a second one also involving alleged election interference. That's in Georgia. That's also a state case brought by Fonnie Willis, who is the DA in Fulton County there. We'll talk about a significant thing that happened in connection with the Court of Appeals just this past week that's likewise going to impact the scheduling, the conduct of that trial. And then we're also going to talk about the status of the major election interference case brought by a grand jury in the District of Columbia, and the pendency, the status of that case, and the fact that there are two cases pending right now before the Supreme Court that will have a significant, a major impact upon the conduct and the scheduling of that trial as well. Necessarily, we move then from that reference to the Supreme Court to others. We're going to continue our review, if you will, of some of the cases that our Supreme Court is going to be deciding imminently, probably in the next 4, maybe 6 weeks at the outside. In the next several weeks, the Supreme Court deciding a number of major cases are going to impact us in many different ways. We'll talk about what is on the docket of the Supreme Court yet to be decided. 62 altogether, 18 decided to this point, many more yet to go. And then we're going to do a little bit of undiscovered justice, as we sometimes do. A couple of stories related to things you probably haven't heard about during the course of this past week. We're going to spend some time chatting about those as well, having to do with a sentencing, having to do with a proposed disposition of one of those cases, and an order for a defendant now to go to prison in the wake of his conviction. We'll talk about those two unrelated but important cases in the rule of law in America as we pursue our agenda here on Amicus Law Review. As always, inviting your inquiries and your questions at 844-967-2789 as we continue with our syllabus, again, involving you in that discussion. Let us begin. Let us begin with that trial in Manhattan, which, to reaffirm the point, is not just about contemporary politics. It is also about the rule of law in America. And this is the kind of thing that our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren will be reading about in the history books, because we have never done this before. There has never been a circumstance in the 240 years of our American history in which a former president has been brought before the bar, brought into a courtroom, tried for criminal cases, as he is being tried these past several weeks, and arguably down the road as well in those other cases. The case presided over by Justice Juan Merchan. Juan Merchan, very, very schooled, experienced, knows what he is doing, and is conducting his trial in a way that makes clear that he is in charge, and he is the one who is responsible not only for ensuring a fair and decent trial, but also for ensuring that when the jury gets this case, it has got the most balanced presentation of all. And what that means is that on a regular basis, the justice is making decisions about those things that can and cannot be introduced into evidence. Sometimes those are in connection with things happening right in the moment when attorneys, as you have sometimes seen on television, will object to particular questions, will object to particular things that a witness may say, and the judge will rule on those right in the moment. That has to do with the application of the evidence rules. But the judge will also make larger decisions about big pieces of information. So, for example, the justice indicated that while he will permit the prosecution to talk about this now famous Access Hollywood tape and the things that Donald Trump said in advance of the 2016 election that were released at the time, while he talks about the ways in which that can be used, he also said that the prosecution cannot use the actual tape itself. Those kinds of determinations, that's an illustration of the kind of thing that the judge does on a regular basis. He also issues orders during the course of the case that ensure, once again, that there is a fair and decent trial. As an aside, questions sometimes about the accuracy, the inaccuracy, the rightness, the wrongness of some of those evidentiary rulings. And the answer, of course, is that you are entitled in America, we would argue, arguably throughout the entire world, to a trial that is fair, a trial that is consistent with the rules of procedure and evidence. You're not entitled to a perfect trial. Indeed, that's an important point. If this case, if there is indeed a conviction down the road as it goes up to appeal, the appeals court is not looking for a perfect trial where everything happened perfectly, but fundamental fairness was delivered. And that's also a part of what animates Judge or Justice Merchan as he issues various orders. Let's talk about what he has done in the past. Let's talk about what he has done just this past week. Judge Juan Merchan admonishing Donald Trump this past week about something that he has said outside of courtroom. And in particular, it has to do with this so-called gag order, a word, again, that I bristle at because, again, no one being gagged, simply defendant being required to comply with basic rules and conditions of the trial itself, requiring that Donald Trump, in this case, not criticize publicly the witnesses, not be name-calling when it comes to anyone else involved as witnesses, jurors, court staff. The judge, interestingly, excludes himself and the prosecutor from that group of people who cannot be attacked. But the reality is that that order imposed upon Donald Trump is also an order that's imposed upon every other defendant in the state and federal courts in this country. We have never had this kind of situation, at least not in this circumstance, where a defendant has consistently gone out there and attacked witnesses, arguably attack the jury selection process, and that's what the judge is trying to prevent. And so, just recently, Donald Trump, both in a rally and also in a interview just outside of the courtroom, has indicated that restriction on him prevents him from testifying in his own behalf. And Judge Merchan took the opportunity this past week to make clear that that simply isn't the case. And we make clear this weekend as well on this broadcast that those are two different things. The judge requiring that the defendant not comment about things that are out there, but also indicating that there are ways in which the trial can proceed. We're going to talk more about all of that here on Amicus, a Law Review.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
Hey folks, this is Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. Today, I'm talking about unclaimed money. I love claiming unclaimed money. Unclaimed money is money that folks leave behind, you know, like old security deposits or bank accounts, tax refunds, uncashed checks, the list goes on. And almost 1 in 7 Americans has some. To see if you are owed money, go to unclaimed.org and search every state where you think you might have had any open accounts. In 2023, over $5 billion was returned to people who claimed it, and I was one of those people. I check the site every so often because new things get added periodically. In the last 5 years alone, I reclaimed over $300 in landlord refunds, and then there was this one old bank account that I thought I'd closed, but turns out I hadn't. It took just a few minutes, and it was really worth it. Okay, folks, that was your Work Money Minute. For more tips and tricks on how to save more and spend less, go to workmoney.org. Until next time, take good care.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matinee on Air.
The Law Review, and I am your host, Jim Santel, this hour and next hour on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Thank you for joining me and my producer, Max. Again, as always, taking your questions or inquiries about our syllabus at 844-967-2789, beginning our broadcast this week and talking about things that Justice or Judge Juan Michon has done in this past week to ensure that justice is done when it comes to the conduct of the trial. Admonishing Donald Trump and telling him that he is wrong when he is communicating out there in the public this notion that somehow the order that requires that he abide by the rules internal to the courtroom somehow would prevent him from testifying on his own behalf. That is a right that every single defendant has. That's what Judge or Justice Michon said to Donald Trump just this past week. And he is free to accept that possibility or not. He can choose to testify on his own behalf, but nothing about what Judge Michon has done prevents that from happening. Donald Trump conflating in some ways those two things and suggesting perhaps that if he doesn't testify, it is because the judge is preventing him from doing so. And Judge Michon saying nothing of the case, that is not true, telling him, Donald Trump, and his attorney that they are wrong, and basically to stop saying that. An important thing about civics, Donald Trump relying in many ways upon the failure of some Americans to engage in critical thinking when it distinguishes between those two concepts. That is, this order, compelling requirements with respect to witnesses and the jury and staff, and this absolute right the defendant has to take the stand if he or she chooses to do so. The judge also in that same connection, just this past week and weeks actually, has imposed some penalties upon Donald Trump for violating the terms of that order as he has gone out there and said things, some name calling, some indications about the witnesses in particular that would suggest that their testimony is not credible. Again, that in violation of the order imposed by Judge Michon. And indeed, up to this point, the judge has imposed a fine of up to $10,000, $1,000 per instance, against Donald Trump as a finding not only of contempt, but a penalty for engaging in violations of that order. Interestingly, along the way, one of the other things that Judge Michon said just this past week was, I want to be very clear that I don't want to put you in jail. I don't want to incarcerate you, to detain you, if indeed you continue to violate the clear mandates of my order. But he went on to say, I will do that. I will put you in prison. I will put you behind bars if you fail to abide. And it appears maybe, just maybe, that was taken to heart by the defendant and perhaps his attorneys as well. When he was asked, Donald Trump, outside of the courtroom by some reporters about some upcoming witnesses, he did not take that bait. He did not go down that road. And maybe, just maybe, that admonition by the judge, not only to abide by the law, but to ensure that the order itself is abided by, that the judge reaffirming that, and that the consequence of continuing violations of that may in fact be detention, maybe that has taken hold with Donald Trump. It's very clear that he is not engaged in further violations of it, but we also have a challenge coming up because this coming Monday, as you know, as we will talk, we have a major witness coming up, and there is great animosity. There is great animosity between Donald Trump and this witness, as there have been other witnesses, including just this past week, Stormy Daniels. And in that connection, another part of this that's also a part of Judge Michon's statements from the bench as he tries to administer a fair, again, not a perfect trial, but a fair trial. He has also commented about the fact that the upcoming witness, again, you know his name, he is Michael Cohen. He is Donald Trump's former lawyer, sometimes referred to as Donald Trump's fixer. as Michael Cohen takes the stand this coming Monday, this coming week, after this weekend broadcast. As we watch that, one of the other great concerns that Judge Merchan has had is that Michael Cohen himself is out there on social media once again attacking Donald Trump, as he has done for years now. They go back and forth. They are sparring, as they will probably, through attorneys, spar on Monday and the days following. Judge Merchan has said that he has taken notice of some of that. He has seen, for example, that Michael Cohen appeared very recently in a social media posting wearing a T-shirt that has Donald Trump emblazoned on the front behind bars. And Judge Merchan has said to the prosecutors, again, this is a prosecution witness, their responsibility, said, when you speak to Mr. Cohen in advance of the testimony of this coming week, tell him, he said, comes right from the bench, that he is not to do those kinds of things, do not appreciate those kinds of things. It will also have an impact upon the conduct of justice in this trial. The judge being very fair, directing not only the defendant comply, but also that witnesses who are coming up not do things that in any way would taint this jury, that would have an impact upon the process that the judge is trying to ensure is fair and decent and right and consistent with our rules of procedure. Also, we know that in the wake of her own testimony, which we will talk about, Stormy Daniels, just this past week, Stormy Daniels herself was online. She went out there and she posted something and talked about the fact that she said real men respond to testimony by being sworn in and taking the stand in court. She went on to talk more about that. And the judge hasn't commented specifically about that. She is now off the bench here. She's no longer testifying. The concern, obviously, is twofold. One is that, again, she is still plainly a part of the history of this case. And my guess is that the judge would take note of that as well, not only because you've got another witness commenting about Donald Trump in a way that he does not like, that is, the judge does not like, does not appreciate, and feels strongly should be prohibited. But with respect to that particular comment by Stormy Daniels, the comment again about suggesting that the defendant should take the stand, the problem with that is that if that had been uttered in court, before the jury, before anybody who's taking in the evidence in this case, making determinations about the facts, which is the jury, that would be a ground for mistrial. Why? You're suggesting that the defendant has an obligation to testify in his own behalf, in his own defense. And that, of course, is contrary not only to our Constitution, but also to the fundamental rules of process in courts. And so that comment, especially, again, in the wake of her own testimony of just this week, also a part of the concern about these extra courtroom statements being made in the public domain. My guess is that the judge will once again be visiting those, not only as Michael Cohen takes the stand this coming week, but also as other witnesses likewise appear before this jury and before him to testify about things, both as a prosecution witness, arguably defense witnesses as well, should apply across the board. All of that in front of Judge Merchan these days. So what do we know? Well, last week at the end of our broadcast, we began to talk about this very compelling testimony from Hope Hicks, the former communications director. And Hope Hicks testifying in particular about the ways in which the campaign was responding in 2016 to this report from the Washington Post indicating that the Access Hollywood tape was known, was about to be released, and the response to that. Her very compelling testimony about the things undertaken by the campaign after that, and the reason for the presentation of that particular testimony and the description given by Hope Hicks is because it provides the motive, if you will. It provides the background for what happens next, which is the concern about any additional information involving any other sexual encounters out there, any other statements or events involving Donald Trump and women who are not his wife. And that is the kind of thing that we're going to talk about as we continue here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. A new report released Friday by the Biden administration finds Israel violated international humanitarian law in Gaza in its use of American-supplied weapons, but lacks enough information to officially make that conclusion, given the nature of the conflict in Gaza. The United Nations General Assembly adopting a resolution recommending the Security Council give favorable consideration to full Palestinian membership. Gilad Erdan, the Israeli ambassador to the UN, telling the assembly Palestine would be Hamas-run.
You have opened up the United Nations to modern-day Nazis, to genocidal jihadists committed to establishing an Islamic State across Israel and the region, murdering every Jewish man, woman, and child. It makes me sick.
The U.S. was one of the few member nations that voted against the resolution. A solar storm giving millions of Americans as far south as Alabama a glimpse of the northern lights. This is ABC News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
The Brewers clobber the Cardinals again. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers jumped out to a lead and never looked back. The final 11-2 over the Cardinals Friday night at AmFam Field. Willy Adames with three doubles, scoring a pair of runs and two RBI. 24-year-old left-hander Robert Gasser holding St. Louis scoreless through six innings in his major league debut. Manager Pat Murphy on Gasser's backstory.
He was disappointed he wasn't brought up last year, and it was until May that he was healthy and ready to go, and he came in determined. He threw the ball great. The breaking ball was really good. Filled up the zone. Really happy for him. Really, really happy for him.
NBA, the Bucks head coach Doc Rivers has fired three assistants that served under Adrian Griffin. Gone are Josh Oppenheimer, Sidney Dobner, and DJ Baker. Joe Prunty, who has served as interim head coach, remains with the team. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm Corey Hartman with your forecast for today. Slight chance of a shower. Otherwise, partly sunny and 66, a bit breezy out of the northwest. For tonight, partly cloudy, 49 with a slight chance of a shower. Chances for showers and thunderstorms on your Sunday afternoon. Otherwise, sunshine, 79. More storms Sunday night.
Currently, 53 degrees.
I'm Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I learned about atrial fibrillation the hard way. My symptoms would come and go, shortness of breath, fatigue. I kept going. Then I got so lightheaded, I couldn't. My doctor said I have AFib, so I'm about five times more likely to have a stroke. Other symptoms, irregular heartbeat, heart racing, chest pain, can come and go, but the risk of stroke stays. If you have symptoms, tell a doctor. Visit notimetowait.com.
Sponsored by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Pfizer.
Are you and your family weather ready? I'm Terry Barr, producer of the Slice of Wisconsin series. Wisconsin weather is ever-changing, and all of us with Civic Media believe awareness can make a difference. Our weather-ready stories will offer the information you need. Here's meteorologist Brittany Merlot.
The weather impacts everything, and the history of windmills includes using the weather. In this case, the wind, to help mill grain and pump water. The modern windmills that you see across Wisconsin today are often called wind turbines. These still use the wind, but now it's to produce electricity. And a new study shows that turbines can also lower the daytime temperature while keeping it warmer at night. The moving air protects crops from frost. It's a weather-ready fact. And Saturday, May 11th, is National Windmill Day. If you really want to celebrate, save June 5th through the 9th. Because it's Windmill Days in Baldwin, Wisconsin, a celebration of Dutch heritage and the windmills in the village. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot.
The Todd Alba Show.
Trumpster asked the judge and said, hey, can I not come to court because I want to go to my son's graduation? So here now, from the Raw story, Trump plans Minnesota fundraiser on the day of Barron's graduation. When I graduated, you have a get-together with family and friends. It's kind of a day. A parent shouldn't just be ducking in and out.
You have to be a parent for that. And he is a parent in name only. A pino.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Todd Alba.
Hey, everybody, join us next time as we'll take a look back at what happened news-wise over the weekend, update you on the Trumpster trials, what's ahead for Joe Biden, and much more for this week on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2.
This is Amicus, the Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this hour and next hour as well. We are talking about witnesses, in particular the credibility of witnesses. What makes a witness credible? What makes a witness incredible? Speaking initially, as we began in our broadcast of last weekend, talking about Hope Hicks and my assessment, I suspect yours and that of the jury as well, a credible witness for a number of reasons. She describes in some graphic detail the reasons for the campaign in 2016, responding very badly to this Access Hollywood tape. And the response is the sense that that cannot happen again. And it sets up, as we have talked before, all the transactions that followed, the work through David Pecker, the work through Michael Cohen in keeping quiet this doorman who's outside of a New York hotel, keeping quiet Karen McDougal about another tryst that she had with the former president, at that time, the future president, and also, of course, the relationship between Stormy Daniels and Donald Trump, all of that set up through the testimony of Hope Hicks describing the conversations that she overheard between Donald Trump and David Pecker talking about this. She confirms there was a crisis inside the campaign. She confirms a lot of things about the relationships among these parties. And she does so in a way that is not only compelling in terms of its factual understanding, it's making sense internally, but she also does something else, which makes her a credible witness, which is she makes it clear that she is pained in doing this. She is uncomfortable in being there. Why? Because plainly, she looks at the defendant here. That is a man, Donald Trump, who gave her employment early on in the campaign, gave her employment in the White House as the communications director, a senior advisor. And after the presentation of her principal prosecution statements on direct testimony, she breaks down and she begins to cry. Not catastrophically at all, but enough for the judge to say, let's take a break while we reconnoiter here and come back together. And the reason that she did that was because it was an acknowledgement of hers internally that this is, as we have often said, this is human tragedy for everybody involved. That kind of thing adds credibility, not because of her tears, not because of the physicality of that, but because it indicates that this is someone who is testifying from the heart, from her brain as well. Intellectually, she is conveying a story that does, in fact, make sense, and she is pained in doing it because, indeed, she, like David Pecker, like some other defendants, other witnesses, rather, who have talked about this particular defendant, they presumably, having been employed by Donald Trump, they like him, they enjoy his company, and they've let that be known to the jury. That makes for a compelling witness. Offer to you this weekend in our broadcast, and offer generally as we go and talk about the credibility of witnesses, that kind of internal emotion and the sense of not only the specificity about what was happening, but also the reasons for the testimony, that makes it all very, very compelling for a jury to understand. Hope Hicks was on the stand a week or so ago and followed again by a number of other witnesses during the course of this past week, all of them providing some additional interstitial information about facts, about transactions that make all of this make sense, if you will, tying together a lot of the factual information. And that culminates late this past week with the testimony of Stormy Daniels. We have talked about some of the things that she's said outside of court. During the course of the trial, of course, she provides also some very, very graphic testimony, about the nature of this relationship that she had when she and Donald Trump were together. Suggesting, again, not only a sexual relationship, but also something of a business relationship as that relationship was going ahead as they had this event a long time ago, some night with Donald Trump about two decades ago, as she testified. Stormy Daniels, for reasons unlike Hope Hicks, also a credible witness. She also provides a story that, while salacious and while certainly the focus of an awful lot of media attention here, also goes on to describe it with specific detail things that make sense about her relationship with Donald Trump. And let me offer this weekend that one of the things that makes her testimony so very compelling is that she tells an imperfect story. She tells an imperfect story about what happens between her and Donald Trump some two decades ago in describing this event itself. During the course of the cross-examination about that story, the attorney for Donald Trump accused the adult film star of fabricating some elements of her story, leveraging her public dispute with Donald Trump to enrich herself and scoring some lucrative book deals, if you will. The details of your story keep changing, right? The attorney said. And Stormy Daniels, as she did throughout the testimony, says, no, that's false. That is simply wrong. Even more significantly than her out-and-out denials of things that are not consistent with the story, an imperfect story that she tells, is just this. And she highlights the imperfection and therefore the credibility of the story that she tells. What happens is that the defense attorney repeatedly asked Daniels about her experience in the porn industry to question elements of the story, suggesting at one point that Daniels was well-practiced in making up stories about sex. The attorney asks, you have had a lot of experience of making phony stories about sex appear to be real. And Stormy Daniels returns and she says, the sex in the films is very real, just like what happened to me in that room. And that exchange repeated throughout this testimony. Stormy Daniels, a strong witness on cross-examination, admitting those things about her past that are real and that are true, but also pushing back on those things and in many ways linguistically responding to the questions as she did just there. And most significantly, in the wake of that pushback during the course of her cross-examination, Stormy Daniels says this, that if she were to have fictionalized her encounter with Donald Trump, she says, I would have written it to be a lot better. I would have written it to be a lot better. And more than anything else, I think that phrase is the takeaway from her testimony. If indeed she was going to tell a big lie about this, defense and Donald Trump obviously maintained that this never happened at all, she would testify about larger, greater events. Significantly, Stormy Daniels, in the specificity of her account, does not describe this as a sexual assault. She doesn't describe what, for example, E. Jean Carroll described in her civil defamation case as an assault, a sexual rape. She doesn't describe that power-type situation. She describes consensual sex. And she describes along the way also the descriptions of the conversation that Donald Trump and she are having both before and after this particular event. I would have written it to be a lot better, a whole lot more compelling, she says, if I was making this up. And indeed, that's a very compelling thing for the jury to understand. If Stormy Daniels was not as credible as she is and was making up a larger story, she could and would have done just that. She doesn't. She describes a story that is consistent with the imperfection, if you will, of the world, that this particular encounter was not an assault in nature, but rather one that was consensual. And that leads to the larger discussion about the reason why Stormy Daniels' testimony is here at all. And that is also an exchange that happens between the attorneys and the judge, Juan Merchan. At some point during the course of the proceedings this past week, actually a couple of times, the attorneys for Donald Trump object to the specificity, the lurid descriptions provided by Stormy Daniels during the course of her testimony. And the judge says that he is surprised. He is surprised by the fact that defense counsel have not intervened and not objected along the way, raising objections to some of the specific things that Stormy Daniels has said in very lurid detail, and says now, however, it is too late. You've lost your opportunity. And so he denies at least a couple of motions to basically turn the entire trial upside down by declaring a mistrial. He says, no, I'm not going to do that at all. But he says, I was surprised when all this information came in without a particular objection or a series of objections from the defense table. All of that a part of the exchange between the judge. Obviously, the discussion also includes from the prosecution this fundamental notion that the entire reason for the presentation of this testimony, the entire reason for the presentation of this very lurid account by Stormy Daniels, is that the defense raised the issue about whether it happened in the opening statement at all. something that the prosecution points out. The judge also indicates, yes, you open the door to this. And the reason why all of that is so very important is just this. This case is not in the end about this sexual encounter. The allegations, as we have said on this weekend broadcast, are all about violations of New York law when it comes to finance and reporting on that, the invoices, the checks, the ledgers, those kinds of things. And frankly, as the prosecution has said in other pleadings and other pretrial matters, don't have to prove the existence or the non-existence of this sexual event that happened. That is not a key element of this, but now that it's been raised by the defense, important not only to rebut the notion that this did not happen, but it also explains, it also puts in context all the other things that happened with Stormy Daniels and sets up unmistakably the testimony that is about to follow. And that is her payment by Michael Cohen of $130,000 to be quiet about that event. All of that discussion, of course, happening outside of the presence of the jury, this back and forth about whether there should be a mistrial in this case, whether there should be objections along the way to Stormy Daniels' very explicit testimony. In the end, the judge denying those mistrial motions, saying, no, we're going ahead with all of this, and finding that even though there probably could have and should have been objections raised along the way, they are not sufficient to turn this otherwise of fair trial into something that's not fair. All of that, once again, in anticipation of the next witness coming up. His name is Michael Cohen, and he is scheduled, according to all reporting, according to the prosecution, according to a lot of the statements in the media as well. He is going to be appearing on Monday, and certainly he is one of the key, if not the key witness, because he is in many ways the person who ties Donald Trump to all of these other transactions. He ties the testimony of David Pecker into all of this. He tries the testimony of Hope Hicks and of Stormy Daniels and all these people who have come forward to testify. He is the one who facilitates the payments through his own account, if you will, the mortgage that he took out on his own home. He is the one who describes the $130,000 payment ultimately made to Stormy Daniels. Now, as we have noted in the past on this broadcast, this particular witness also subject not only to direct questioning, which will be a part of the prosecution presentation, that will probably take a couple of days to put in evidence, but also cross-examination. And like all of the witnesses, to greater and lesser degrees, Michael Cohen will be subject to cross-examination in this matter, an awful lot of cross-examination. We know, for example, that he has indeed lied in the past, not only to Congress, but also to investigators. He has suffered his own federal criminal conviction. He has spent time in prison. He is still on paper, so to speak. We've talked about his own business conduct, which is also, at a minimum, very unpleasant. And we've talked about his bias, his overt bias against Donald Trump himself. All of that will be the subject of cross-examination as this trial continues. Once again, the challenge with Michael Cohen is going to be, in the midst of all of that, all sorts of reasons not to like Michael Cohen, all of that, does it also give you a reason to distrust the things that he is saying? Does it prompt a jury to say that because of all of that baggage, and there is a lot of it, does it prompt you to say that the things that he is describing, therefore, did not happen? There will be certainly a defense argument. It is a viable argument that basically says that if the witness is not believable in some areas, you can disbelieve that witness in other areas. The judge will instruct on all of that. But the question before the jury is, can I believe this particular witness, even with all of this other baggage? And the significance there of all the testimony up to now is also all about the corroboration. Everything leading up to this, Michael Cohen provides a centerpiece to it, but also supported by the transactions, the phone records, the other testimony of the live witnesses there, all of this being brought together inside the testimony beginning on Monday in this trial of Donald Trump in the state court there in Manhattan. I'm going to talk more about trials in America here on our broadcast as we continue to chat about the rule of law in America.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
The fantastic Jane Matt Nair of Matt Nair on Air. I'm a big fan of like the Rose Bowl, the Orange Bowl, the Cotton Bowl. Well, now from Snoop Dogg, they're going to have the Snoop Bowl, the Snoop Bowl. How about that, Jane?
I think we're missing the obvious. Where's the Punch Bowl? Where's the Toilet Bowl? I think that there are other bowls that are being neglected.
I think it could maybe be the Snooper Bowl, though.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Mino and the Mayor.
Did you see the dumbest thing I did? Catherine, who we just love here, she runs the whole company pretty much. She brought like Blues Brothers glasses. So she wanted us all to walk in together wearing the black glasses. So we're sitting in the thing and I'm reading the program. Reach my glasses where I always carry it, put them on. It's like, holy crap, they dropped the lights. Now I can't read anything. So I take them off. I'd put my sunglasses on. How dumb is that?
Mino and the Mayor, weekday morning 6 until 9 on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
We have spent the better part of this first hour of our weekend broadcast talking all about the witnesses, witness credibility, what kinds of things we should take away from the recent witnesses presented in the criminal trial in state court in Manhattan, the trial of Donald Trump for these violations, alleged violations of New York state law. There are other cases pending, as we well know, throughout our nation. Let's do an inventory of some of those because significant events happened just this past week that are going to affect the trial conduct, the scheduling of a trial in those matters as well. Let's go to the Mar-a-Lago case. This is a federal case. It is pending before Judge Eileen Cannon. She is a federal district court judge in Fort Pierce. That's the Southern District of Florida. That's the federal district in which she is presiding over this case. And a lot of history there, including her own oversight of a civil action that predated the criminal case in which she basically almost stopped the investigation going forward before the 11th Circuit put an end to that. Now she is presiding again over the criminal trial that alleges in many counts against Donald Trump and two others, not only a violation, some obstruction of justice, but also violations of federal law when it comes to the management, the taking, the use, the possession of classified documents and non-classified documents once in the presidential domain. In that connection, a lot of pretrial work going on right now in front of Judge Eileen Cannon. And a lot of that has to do with how you handle in what will one day be a public trial, these national security matters that are set forth in these classified documents. Do you release those publicly? Are they handled in some way that ensures the integrity, the non-disclosure of that information? And if so, how is that done? Again, to ensure a fair trial in front of her. A lot of that under what's called the Classified Information Procedures Act. It is a lot of work. And there are also other pretrial motions similarly pending in front of her, even to this day. This past week, invoking all of that, Judge Eileen Cannon issued a fairly brief order, but a dramatic order given the status of the case. We know that up to now, the trial in that Mar-a-Lago documents case was scheduled to begin in a little over a week or so on May 20th was the trial date that she had initially set. This past week, she entered an order saying, because at this juncture, I've got so many matters before me, including pretrial motions, these matters under the Classified Information Procedures Act, interconnected pretrial petitions of various kinds, various pending pretrial matters to attend to, all of that necessary to present this case to a jury. It is prudent, she said, it's appropriate for me to take that trial off of the calendar and put this, delay the start of the trial. And she has, in fact, taken that court trial, that trial before her, the jury trial, off the calendar, no longer on May 20th, almost assuring that given the pendency of all of this, that she will not be trying this case sometime in this calendar year. Likely this case will be tried sometime in 2025, if not beyond. Lots of things to address there. The significance of her order just this past week, removing that trial date and indicating that we've got a lot of work to do before the time of an actual jury impanelment. All of that coming out of Fort Pierce and Judge Eileen Cannon just this past week. Two other matters also happening in other trials, other matters pending, other criminal prosecutions of Donald Trump. One of them, the Georgia prosecution. This is also an election interference case, as you well know. In that case, Judge Scott McAfee, previously having dismissed six counts for some bad pleading, some bad drafting aspects of it, but the charges go forward with respect to many, many defendants in that case. The judge in that case, Scott McAfee, previously having determined that Fannie Willis, based upon this relationship that she had with somebody inside her office, her lead prosecutor on the case, that she could still remain on the case. There was nothing about that that posed an overt conflict of interest such that she would have to be removed from the case or her office would be removed from the case, but nonetheless found that there was an appearance of impropriety in that, a major order that we have discussed at great length on this broadcast. In the wake of that, of course, the prosecution proceeds, and Scott McAfee has continued to entertain pretrial motions, other things in connection with that. But along the way, Scott McAfee also said, he also certified, said to the defense, if you want to take me up on appeal on that decision not to disqualify Fannie Willis and to keep her in place and her office in place, I will let you do that. And issued a certificate of appealability, if you will. Well, just this past week, the appeals court granted that appeal, basically saying, we will hear this case. Did not decide the case, but decided to take the case and review whether or not Scott McAfee's lower court decision is proper and accurate. That is significant. That is significant for a couple of reasons. One is it may signal that the appeals court there wants to do something, arguably, to change, maybe even to reverse outright the decision entered by Judge McAfee below. We don't know. We don't know what the exact purpose or the focus of the appeal might be, but that is a possibility. The appeals court plainly could have decided not to take the case, in which case it simply would, the matter would have proceeded in front of Judge McAfee as it is presently proceeding. And the other piece of this, the fact that the appeals court is now taking on a review of this decision about whether or not Fannie Willis will continue and her office continue to prosecute this case, is that too also makes it virtually impossible for that particular trial to go to trial anytime in this calendar year. Unlikely that the Scott McAfee trial, that case involving election interference in Georgia there in Fulton County, will be resolved at any time before the end of this year. Now that the appeals court is also taking a look at who is going to prosecute, whether or not this predicate, this initial decision by the district court, by the trial court to keep her on the case, needs to be revisited. And arguably, we don't know, but arguably reversed. And if indeed that happens, it also would postpone dramatically the conduct of that trial. And finally, we've got the Trump election interference case. That's the one pending in front of Tanya Chutkan. She is the federal district court judge in Washington, D.C. And we know that that case, too, has been suspended since the springtime while the Supreme Court addresses a couple of major, very significant issues pending that will affect the future of that trial. One of them has to do with the statute under which the case involving a defendant named Fisher was prosecuted, 18 U.S.C. Section 1512, determining whether or not that particular statute can be used to address people who were rioting on the Capitol grounds on January 6th. That statute also implicated in the indictment against Donald Trump. And then there's a larger immunity issue that this Supreme Court has also been entertaining recently. Those two cases, presumably decisions issued in June, depending upon what they do with those cases, could also dramatically affect the conduct of that trial, making it very difficult, if not impossible, for Eileen Cannon to go ahead and prosecute and present that case down the road. We have a second hour coming up here on our show, Amicus.
This is the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. Civic Media.
Do you owe back taxes? Call Tax Solutions now and get some help. For a limited time, the IRS offers a tax forgiveness program called the Fresh Start Initiative. Our team can make it easier for you to pay back taxes, avoid tax liens, and get a fresh start.
I call Tax Solutions now, and they got the IRS off my back.
Call Tax Solutions now. 800-281-8193. 800-281-8193. 800-281-8193.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.